Laird Ethelbert's troop rode hard to the south, arriving in Ethelbert de Centel only a few hours later. Ethelbert immediately convened his generals and explained the shifting situation. Mirick and Tyne took the same line as Afwin Wi, begging their laird to stay put, to let the Powrys aid their cause. But Kieran Howen stood quietly, doubt clear on his face.
You remember those skirmishes along the Black Rocks of the coast?
Laird Priday and his champion Bonnegren showed well in the fighting. Glad I was to be on their flank, for even the men of Pridetown fought better than any others. Except our own, of course. I am not surprised that Bonnegren, the Bear of Haunts, has risen to such prominence among the ranks.
Powrys striking all along the river, they claim.
They need us.
Several hard stares turned on Cormac for speaking out of turn, but Ethelbert didn't look his way and kept exchanging his glance with Kieran Howen.
Had Laird Bonnegren agreed to secure our march, it might have been an opportunity to heal Haunts.
Indeed, it might have been.
Then make it so.
If Powrys are climbing from the Mesa del Aval, then the Mirianic coast is not secure.
And without the guarantee of Laird Bonnegren, I would not risk a man of Ethelbert de Centel. Even with Bonnegren's word of honor, which he did not grant, I would be a fool to put my garrison on the field near to the superior numbers of treacherous Yezelnik. You see the world with the optimism of a priest, truly, but I view it through the eyes of responsibility.
If we do not go forth and aid against the Powrys, when they are defeated, Yezelnik will send Bonnegren and many thousands back against us. We cannot hope to win.
Then mayhap we should hope that the miserable bloody caps will kill enough of Yezelnik's men to deter him from that march. Or enough, perhaps, so that we can steal the advantage and destroy them all. Your bargaining is not with me, young brother. You wish to turn Laird Bonnegren from the side of the fool Yezelnik. Go then, and quickly, and catch up to his march. If the ways of the world turn the Bear of Haunts from the cause of the idiot king, he will ever have a potential ally here in Ethelbert de Centel. We do not forget the days of yore when Bonnegren and Laird Priday fought on our flank.
It was something, at least, Cormac silently mused. With Ethelbert's blessing and that of Father Destros, he and Milcaela started out soon after, back to the northwest. Two others watched their departure. Afwin Wi and Murwal Yana did not offer any such blessing or words of encouragement.
I do not trust this Bonnegren.
Trust?
If Ethelbert and Bonnegren, and thus Yezelnik, unite against the Powrys, then this young king will demand retribution for the death of Delaval. They will only find true alliance through the action of mock justice.
Fear not, for Ethelbert will not turn against me.
He is a desperate man. We should leave now, for Jacinta.
This work is lucrative and enjoyable. You fear these barbarians? We have just the two hunting us back in Bear. And I would rather face the whole of Yezelnik's army than hide again in the shadows of Jacinta's streets. We will not leave.
When a peace is brokered, we will be sacrificed to it.
Peace?
So let there be no peace.
Afwin Wi and Murwal Yana were called to Laird Ethelbert's side again late that afternoon for a continued discussion of their options. The three remaining followers of Afwin Wi, led by Mo Li, a man sorely injured by Branson in the fight that had driven the highwayman from Afwin Wi's gang, departed Ethelbert de Centel soon after sunset, following the path of Cormac and Milcaela. Every step he took moved him farther from his sword, from the artwork, the legacy of his mother, Sen Wi. That thought nagged at Branson and pulled against him like an invisible rope. But he stubbornly kept going. He focused instead on what lay ahead, on Kaedale, his beloved, pregnant with his child.
It is not my fight.
He kept going. What he lacked in speed, he made up for with endurance, walking long into the night and moving again at first light. He didn't recognize the trails this far to the east, though, and so he kept his road straight to the north. To the Gulf, he figured, then a turn to the west and St. Mirabel. He passed by several villages, not raised like those in the south or those closer to the coast, where Milwellis had wound a path of destruction similar to that of King Yezelnik on their respective retreats from Ethelbert de Centel. Branson resisted the urge to go into any of those settlements. He was lonely, to be sure, but that was his way now, he reminded himself. He was walking the second road of Jamestown Sequin, the correct road, he now believed, where his focus was himself and his needs, a little corner of the world where he could escape the greater madness of mankind. Unlike Jamestown, he would have Kay Dale and their child and Callan with him. And what else did they need? What more could the hectic and troubled world offer? He came upon the coast one bright morning, and he eagerly turned for the west, hoping that he was not too far from St. Mirabel in Caedale. He wanted nothing more than to be in her arms, to be back across the gulf into Vanguard, where he and his family could forget the rest of the world as Jamestown had done for all those years. It had been Jamestown's tragic mistake to forsake that reclusive lifestyle, Branson believed. The scout should have remained in the wilds of Vanguard, the forests he called home, and let the petty wars of petty lairds solve themselves in blood. For what did it matter, anyway? Whichever laird won, whichever religion, Sam Haste or Abel, had proven victorious in Vanguard, whichever kingdom, Haunts or Bear or Alpinador, gained supremacy, mattered not at all in the end. Even Dame Guaidra, far better to her people than a selfish fop like Yeselnik, would be only a very temporary reprieve, after all, in the long scheme of the world. Should Guaidra win, another Yeselnik or Priday or Ethelbert would soon enough arise to seize the throne, and quite likely, yet again, through the spilled blood of peasants. Branson couldn't escape his conclusion. It remained nothing but a sad joke. Reports came into Father Primujan's command room nearly every hour. The spirit-walking brothers of St. Mirabel had reached the far shore of the Gulf of Corona and bid the vanguardsmen to come forth. They had monitored Dawson's progress and the continuing retreat of the Delaval and Palmaristown warships. They had followed Prince Milwellis's hard march back to the Maeser Delaval and paid keen attention to the remaining forces commanded by Panlimaris as the irate laird continued the siege and bombardment of the chapel. The spirit-walking brothers knew everything going on in this region of Hunt, the placement of ships and warriors, and even the beleaguered condition of Panlimaris's overworked crews.
They will be more eager to break to the west and run for home.
Brother Giavno spoke in the command room session that afternoon.
If we fill their eastern flank with a hard assault of gemstone magic and send them in flight, a larger waiting force in the west will have little trouble in massacring them.
Is that what you advise?
It would seem the prudent military option.
But is it in your heart, brother?
Brother Giavno merely looked away.
You are a good man. I have little desire to massacre Panlimaris's force or any men of Haunts. Let us sweep them from the field and send them running, but all quarter will be offered at all times.
Lady, I remind you that we will be outnumbered more than 2-1.
They will be caught completely without their guard, Brother Jurgian. And every report shows them to be a haggard and exhausted bunch, worked to the point of collapse. Let our initial assault be full of lightning and fire, explosions and great noise and shouts of war. They will break and run.
That Panlimaris will not run.
Then we will kill him. Let there be no doubt that we have entered the battle, that we now fight in the war. It is not our preference, surely, but neither was it our choice or doing. Bitter experience over many months has taught us a vanguard that in such a struggle to the death, the lessening of violence does not lessen the misery. Nay, it is the truth of war that brutal and swift is oft the most merciful way.
But with all offer of quarter.
Then let it begin. At dawn tomorrow, the catapults of lead Panlimaris will fall silent at last.
Every former prisoner residing at the chapel, nearly 400 men and women, reaffirmed his or her allegiance to the Order of Blessed Abel, and all were ready and eager to go out and fight under the banner of Dame Guaidra. All the day they spoke of Brother Fatus, who had walked from Laird Panlimaris's line, who had suffered the spears of his enemy, but had not relented until he had reached the gates of the chapel, whereupon he had gone happily to his just and everlasting reward. They would fight for the order of Dame Guaidra, and, most of all, for the memory of Brother Fatus. The faring began that night, two lines of water-walking monks escorting the warriors to the shoreline to the east and west of St. Mirabel. Brothers Pinar and Giavno personally escorted Dame Guaidra and promised to fight by her side until they drew their last breath. It went on all through the first hours of quiet darkness. Soon after midnight, the 200 warriors and 40 monks beside Dame Guaidra in the east sorted their ranks and recited their strategy, while in the west, across Panlimaris's line, half of those numbers in warriors and monks dug into strategic positions, quite confident of the route of retreat. Moving along the coast, long after the sun had dipped below the western horizon, Branson spotted a dark but definite encampment to the south. At first, he thought to simply pass by and continue on his way, for Saint Mirabel loomed in the west, high in the distance against the starry sky, but not so far away. With the assistance of the Cat's Eye Agate, he would arrive this night, even if he allowed himself this small detour. He quickly discerned that it was a military camp, and he glanced often at the distant chapel, guessing that these were enemies of that place where Kaedale and Callan slept. He still wanted no part of the war, but certainly he would not allow his stubbornness to endanger his beloved wife and his unborn child. He decided that he would return to the chapel with much information of this force in the east. He even pulled his mask up, assuming once more that alter ego he had known in Pride Town. Slipping past the outer guards proved no difficult task for the stealthy highwayman. He noted many monks among the soldiers and feared that the wretched guild had garnered a strong following in short order. He spotted only one fire, small and obviously shielded from distant eyes. He crept along in the branches, nearing the close perimeter of the few seated about the low-burning flames. And then he lost his breath, as among the few near the fire, he recognized Brother Pinaur of Saint Mirabel, Brother Giovno, and none other than Dame Guaidra herself. Dumbstruck, and suddenly afraid that Saint Mirabel might have fallen, Branson dropped from the branches to the ground.
Stand or die!
I am Branson Garabon.
Branson!
Giovno rushed up beside the highwayman and clapped him on the shoulder.
A fine night it is, then.
He ushered Branson through the line of nodding soldiers and monks to join Guaidra and Pinaur by the fire.
And a fine meeting.
Blessed Abel is shining on us this night.
Aye, and the old ones are looking to our cause.
The chapel. Kaedale and Callan?
Faring well. Behind thick walls, Yeselnik cannot breach.
But you are out here in the open night.
The alliance has been sealed with Laird Ethelbert. I am out to further our needs.
I came from the encampment of Laird Bonnegran of Pride, and from a parley with Laird Ethelbert and Cormac and Michaela.
Fine news! It is our hope that Bonnegran will turn to our cause.
What said he?
He told Laird Ethelbert to go home. And better for your cause if you had never allied with that murderous old fool.
All three exchanged glances, then turned their eyes upon Branson.
Ethelbert's assassins murdered Jameston Sequin.
Jameston Sequin? Murdered? On Laird Ethelbert's command?
I know not and I care not if Ethelbert was involved. I found Jameston dead in an abandoned cottage, and I have no doubt as to whose weapon struck him down. That man, a warrior of Bear, serves Ethelbert as a mercenary, and he accompanied a fellow assassin from Bear, a woman named Afwin Wee, to murder King Delavore as well.
How do you know this?
I was there in their court. The broken sword found in King Delavore's chest was the blade of Afwin Wee, Laird Ethelbert's prime assassin.
Again, Pinaur, Giovno, and Guaidra looked to each other blankly, surprised by the news, and out of that stupor came Brother Pinaur, eyeing Branson more closely.
You wear a headband above your mask.
To hold a soul stone to my forehead.
But the brooch Father Otto Levin gave to you
was torn from my head by Ethelbert's assassin. She carries it now, and my sword. I barely escaped with my life. Afwin Wee is trained as a jester too, and is surrounded by other formidable warriors.
Laird Ethelbert meant to kill you?
I doubt he knew anything of it. It was personal with Afwin Wee.
This happened at Laird Bonnegrant's camp?
Staring into the flames, Branson recounted his journey to Pride Town and to the coast beside Jameston, then detailed the time he had spent with Afwin Wee in the court of Ethelbert. He saw no reason to hide anything from this group. He told them of his fight and escape and of the journey along the devastated Southland that had taken him again to Pride and to the march with Bonnegran and Riandu and 15,000 warriors back to the east.
And so I left them. For their fight is not my fight, and I no longer care which side prevails.
You say that to Dame Guaidra's face. You have no shame, then.
Shame? You who march to war would speak to me of shame.
Branson, what has happened to you? Walk with me. Your troubled soul wounds me.
Branson looked at her doubtfully, but he did stand and walk off arm in arm.
Laird Ethelbert has joined us in alliance. It is necessary for both of us to hold any hope of turning back the scourge that is Yeselnik. I will see to it that your sword is returned to you. And the brooch? Surely you wish those items returned?
I do not deny that. But I care hardly as much as you believe.
What is it, Branson? What has happened to you? You are not the same man who departed St. Mirabel. Indeed, you seem more akin to...
The man you first encountered, tricked into your service by your man Dawson?
Yes.
I am no mercenary.
Of course you aren't.
Yet you used me as one, did you not? I served as Dame Guaidra's mercenary, her assassin, to go and slay Ancient Bodin.
You know the truth of Ancient Bodin. You know that it was right and good and necessary that he be slain.
I went for reasons of personal gain, as a mercenary.
And you admitted to me that had you understood the greater truth of the war in Vanguard, you would have gone of your own volition without need for such reward. Nor did you go as a profiteer even before you understood the greater good. You went for the sake of your freedom and for the good of your family, and that is a noble cause, not the crass gold-hunting of a mercenary. Surely, Branson, your mood cannot be of any fears that you are no better than those who do murder for Laird Ethelbert's gold.
It does not matter.
Truly it does.
No, it does not matter because none of it matters. The way of the world is war, and the unscrupulous will ever rise to rule.
He turned back to regard her. He found her standing straight, hands on hips, scowling after him.
Not you. I know that you rule Vanguard wisely, and I doubt not that you would serve as a wonderful queen of haunts, and that the lives of your peasants would be bettered by your actions.
You just said that it matters not.
Because you are a mortal woman, after all, and so fleeting is life. The cycle of misery can be interrupted, but it cannot be stopped.
I do not believe that.
Our great and glorious cause is a fool's errand. Even should Bonagran turncoat against Yeselnik, even should we march to Delavol and seat you as Queen of Haunts, there will always be another Ancient Bodin, or King Yeselnik, or Laird Pridey, or Father the Guild to take it back. I understand now why the Jester two dwell in a remote mountain fortress far from the politics of men. With their strength and knowledge, they could likely shape the world, but they too realize the futility of it all. Jameston Sequin should have stayed in the northern woods.
His cause was just.
Just and hopeless. One good soul against a castle wall topped with unjust enemies.
We can win the day for Hans. I believe that young Yeselnik has erred in his decree to the Order of Blessed Abel. He has pushed the goodly brothers too far with his demands of execution and betrayal, and they...
She paused when she looked upon Branson, shaking his head as if none of it mattered.
What road for Branson, then? I cannot force you to march with me, of course, and trust that you'll never support Yeselnik.
That you can trust, yes. I am bound for St. Mirabel and the arms of my wife. By our agreement, you will sail me wherever I choose, and I choose Vanguard, not to serve you. To find a place where I and my family can live in peace, away from the stupidity of the wider world.
You will run and hide in a forest?
It was good enough for Jameston Sequin.
Kaedale's mother might now consider Dawson McKeague part of that family, for they have fallen in love.
The news caught Branson by surprise, obviously, but he merely gave his signature helpless shrug yet again and moved on.
I cannot get you to Vanguard. And surely not with a pregnant Kaedale beside you?
I have your word.
You have the Gulf of Corona swimming with Palmaris Town and Delavol City warships. There is no safe passage. So what then for Branson?
To remain with Kaedale and St. Mirabel as long as Father Otto Leven allows it.
Father Otto Leven is dead, peacefully and of natural cause. Father Primujan is seated at the head of the Order of Blessed Abel now, a worthy successor to a fine man.
And when that successor is not so worthy?
You are running and hiding.
You should be glad that I am, and that I am not continuing my bargain with Bonagran to aid in his fight with Ethelbert.
That is a fight we hope to avert.
When I learned of your alliance with Laird Ethelbert, out of deference to you, I rescinded my agreement with Bonagran and departed.
Guaidra's smile showed that she saw right through him.
And now you are again the same Branson who first came to Vanguard, full of cynicism.
Accepting of reality.
You had grown so much. Tell me, Highwayman, if we could go back to that time you first came into Vanguard, but with all the knowledge you have gained these last months, Would you join with me and go after Ancient Barden?
Do you even care that Ethelbert murdered Jamieston?
You do not know that to be true. You yourself said it was likely personal with Afwen Wee. Of course I care. The death of Master Sequin wounds me profoundly. He was a great and accomplished man, and I was proud to call him a friend.
But you would look past it for the sake of this alliance you so desperately need, even if you discovered Ethelbert knew of his assassin's work.
I am responsible for the people of Vanguard, some 50,000 souls, all weary of war. King Yeselnik has already begun his assault on my shores. Would you have me throw away Vanguard's only hope?
If Laird Ethelbert is your only hope, then you have already lost.
The alliance between Vanguard and Ethelbert and St. Mirabel purchases leverage to bring more lairds to our cause. Few would follow King Yeselnik if they came to believe in an alternative ruler who might defeat him on the field.
If you wish to lessen the misery of all, then just surrender to Yeselnik. Let the war end. Let him go back to Delavol as you go home to Vanguard.
And allow him to claim all of Hans as his domain?
Why would you care, if not for foolish pride? Do you believe that Yeselnik the idiot will know enough about the goings-on and your far-distant holding to truly interfere?
The people of Hans proper cry out in despair. I cannot ignore that plea.
Only those who crave their own power cry out. For the rest, be it Yeselnik or Ethelbert, Quaidra or Premujon now, they care not. They only want the war to end.
And when King Yeselnik, secure in Hans, decides that Hans is not enough? When he sails an armada to Bear to wage a wider war? When he marches through Vanguard on his way to conquer the Alpinadoran tribes?
You do not know he will do that.
I know that he is without mercy and that he is full of treachery. He would have the monks execute all the prisoners taken from Ethelbert's ranks.
And all your own actions are for the cause of the common man? None of this is for the gain of Dame Gwydra?
The woman looked at him as if he had struck her.
A pox on all your houses. If I cared at all which of you won the worthless throne, then perhaps I would fight, but since I do not...
You can lie to me, Branson Garibond, but you cannot lie to yourself. Listen to your own words, for they speak not to the truth in your heart. That is the source of your malady. That is why you again need the gemstone tied tightly to your forehead. When your heart is not right, so too will go astray your body and mind.
You know nothing of me.
Perhaps I do not. Perhaps I was wrong to think so highly of Branson Garibond.
Perhaps you were. Would you rescind your writ of passage then, Queen of Haunts?
Dame Gwydra wore a sour expression. She shook her head, though in response to his question, or simply to show her disgust, Branson could not fathom. Branson didn't even follow her back to the camp to rejoin the monks. He just walked off to the north and the coast, then to the west, chewing his lip with rage every step of the way. He began to see signs of the besieging force as St. Mirabel came into clear sight, sitting high upon its cliff, unscalable from the ocean and a fairly steep ascent from all other directions. Branson climbed a tree to gain a better view of the field and the situation. Directly down the hill from a front gate, he saw the line of catapults, and even as he watched, one let fly a large stone. It arced through the air to hit the turf directly before the wall. They were halfway between midnight and dawn, and still Ethelbert's catapults were throwing? The sight alarmed Branson, for Kaedale was within those walls. He quickly sprinted to the wall, his strides lengthening as he fell into the malachite, great bounds like that of a hunting cat or a fleeing deer. With Kaedale in his thoughts, the highwayman would not slow. The malachite's power flowing through his limbs, he seemed to simply run up the wall. He leaped down to the courtyard, sprinting across the way to the room he had shared with Kaedale. His relief at seeing her, eyes and smile wide with surprise and pure joy, was matched only by the sincere sense of calm that came over him when she wrapped him in a great hug. They fell asleep in each other's arms, all tears and giggles, and Branson felt as if he could stay there, could hide there forevermore. It proved a short respite, for barely a couple of hours later, Callan Dwornay burst into the room.
It's begun! Oh, it's begun! And a beautiful thing it is!
What?
Gwydra's fight, don't you know? Sweeping the field, she is! Oh, come and look!
Branson and Kaedale scrambled out of bed and dressed quickly, then rushed out of the keep and across the courtyard to join all of those remaining inside St. Mirabel atop the front wall. Magical lightning bolts crackled in the early morning air. By the time he reached the parapet, slowing only to help Kaedale up the last couple of steps, several lines of thick black smoke rose into the dawn's light.
They're burning the catapults!
Branson moved right up to the wall and peered over intently. The rout was on before him, and truly, it was a lopsided affair. Gwydra and her force had charged in from the east, from in front of the rising sun.
We've suffered the rocks every day and every night.
Branson nodded. A large group of Panlimaris' men broke away to the west in full panic and retreat, and Branson spied the large man, the Laird himself, screaming at them and waving his great sword.
All quarter offered! These misled warriors are our brothers and sisters!
Branson felt as if the slightest breeze might knock him from his feet.
Get out there!
Branson turned to stare at Kaedale incredulously.
This is your fight! This is our fight, as surely as any we have ever known.
I am done with fighting. It doesn't matter. None of it matters.
You cannot be thinking that Queen Gwydra will be as ill-tempered as King Yezelnik. What fool's got you, boy?
Don't you see? Even should we seat Gwydra on Delavol's own throne, it would be but a temporary reprieve, a short pause of misery.
Branson!
It's the truth. I've come to know that, and it pains me greatly. The road men walk as a roundabout. There is no better way to be found.
How can you say such things?
Too many who believed otherwise have died in vain. My father and mother...
In vain, you say? But your ma saved that girl you hold.
Garibond and Jamieston? All dead, and to what end?
And what would you have us do?
Run away to the north, to the forest, once home to Jamieston Sequin, and far from this madness.
To live as hermits in the woods, then?
Free of lairds, free of church, free of war.
Kaedale stepped back and pulled her hands free, one of them coming up to cover her mouth.
Dame Gwydra will honor the terms and will sail us to...
You would do that to our child!
Kaedale!
Hit him again!
Why did you ever get up?
Branson looked at her perplexed.
When they knocked the stock into the mud, why did you get back up?
What nonsense!
No nonsense! If it all means nothing, then why'd the stork ever climb out of the mud? If there's nothing to be gained, then why didn't you just lay there and die in the soft black muck of nothing?
It's a roundabout. A walk in a circle to the same awful places again and again.
More of an egg, and a rolling one at that. Oh, the road's going back sometimes. Too often times. But it's rolling forward so long as men and women of heart and cause are moving it so. The world's a better place than it was when Callan went into the Samhazed sack of snakes, don't you doubt? And it is a better place than when Callan's ma was a girl and half at Pride starved to death.
Kaedale grabbed Branson by the front of his shirt and pulled him to face her directly.
We've a chance now. Right now, and it's one worth taking. You go push the road, the roundabout, whatever you may call it, forward. For me, and for our baby that's in my womb. And for yourself, my love. You'll not forgive yourself if you run away.
Or you'll not forgive me.
I could never not love you, my stork. But don't you wallow there in the mud. You get up. This is our fight, all of us, and I only wish I could go with you, weapon in hand and song on my lips. Dame Gwydra deserves your sword.
I have no sword.
Get the highwayman a sword, you damn fools!
Several men on the wall rushed away. Branson looked at his mother-in-law and Callan shrugged.
Father Otto Levin's church stood against Yezelnik. They stood for mercy and justice and at great cost. Would you abandon them now?
A young monk rushed up and thrust a sword into Branson's hand, nodding hopefully. Branson turned from the eager young man to Kaedale, who reached up, holding a thin black strip of cloth. She tied his mask on his face.
Go!
And then she offered him her hand, as she had when he had lain in the mud on that long ago day. Branson took her hand and kissed it softly. Then he nodded to the others and jumped over the wall.
Get up, you damn child!
Laird Panlimaris tried to kick at the soldier who huddled upon the ground, but the desperate Laird staggered as he did and nearly fell.
No, my lord! No! Please, I beg!
The large old Laird spun about, inadvertently drawing a circle in the bloody dirt with his low-hanging sword. He looked for his men.
To me, men! To me!
But alas, there were none about. None who would answer that call, at least. He had been routed, his army driven from the field around him. Not far to the east, the sun now raised above them, Dame Guaidra and her line reformed, grim-faced, their banners high. To a man and woman they stared at the laird of Palmaris Town.
Come on, then!
Panle Maris lifted his sword awkwardly, the movement nearly throwing him from his feet. The blood on the ground about him was his own. Garish wounds crisscrossed his arms and eyes, and so bloody was one side of his face that he couldn't see out of that eye.
You are defeated, Laird Panle Maris.
The Dame of Vanguard and those around her advanced within a few strides of the man. Flanking her left and right, brothers Pinaur and Giavno each lifted a hand, presenting Graphite, the Stone of Lightning.
Ah, you witch!
Panle Maris reached back his sword arm as if to throw. The stubborn old man did not fall over, though. He held his balance. He looked hatefully at Guaidra and lifted his sword arm yet again. A black form rushed across in front of him before the monks could even loose their second volley. The Laird of Palmaris Town staggered back again, a look of stupefaction on his weathered face. Stupefaction rooted more in the realization that he was dead than by the appearance of the highwayman on the field. For in his passing, the highwayman had slashed the threatening old laird's windpipe.
Welcome home, highwayman.
I knew from the moment I opened my eyes, or rather from the instant my eyes popped wide, that some deep and unexplored thought had forced itself upon me. It took me a few moments to even recall where I was, there in the quiet room in the dark night. What great comfort was Kaedale's steady breathing in the bed beside me. We were in our room at St. Mirabel the night after the rout of Laird Panle Maris. The next day promised to be full of carrion birds and large graves and the awful smell that had become all too common across the breadth of the land. And then what? There was talk of a fleet sailing in, full of vanguard warriors ready to march beside Dame Guaidra. There was talk of marching in pursuit of Prince Milwellis, and... oh, if another such victory as the one of this morning could be achieved, then wouldn't King Yeselnik run and hide in Castle Delavore? There was talk of war. It was all the talk, brothers and commoners alike. And despite my report regarding the happenings in the south and Pride Town, Guaidra and Primujan, Pinaur, and all the others still held hope that Bonagran would turn to their side. If he did not, given his skill and the 15,000 warriors he commanded, he could likely sweep the field of Guaidra and the force from Hontz and of Ethelbert as well, should that laird come forth. That terrible truth was the catalyst that had led to the epiphany that had so thrown me from my slumber. Bonagran of Pride. He seemed such a simple man, strong of arm and straightforward of intent. He was the consummate general, or the consummate footman. It mattered not what role was thrust upon him. But did it matter, I wondered, which enemy he was asked to slay? That was my epiphany, that Bonagran of Pride was not akin to Afwin Wee. They were greatly similar, of course, for both had spent their lives in training for battle, and both served their masters ferociously. But while Afwin Wee did so for personal gain, for gold even, the same could not be said of Bonagran. For Bonagran, serving Laird Pridey or King Yeselnik or any other is a response to a sense of duty, a belief that such was his place in the world, his purpose in the world. The Hulei tradition is that of the pure mercenary and thus strictly amoral by definition. The true incarnation of a Hulei warrior is the perfection of the physical and the denial of the emotional. Could Bonagran be said to be a Hans version of Bear's Hulei? No. I do not even hesitate in answering that question. The man has left too many clues to the contrary. If Afwen Wee were the Dame of Pride, she would not have let me live when I was captured there recently, or she would have crippled me beyond repair and dragged me to Yeselnik so that he could enjoy my execution. Afwen Wee would have not allowed the prisoners who were held at Chapel Pride to don the robes of the Order and escape King Yeselnik's sentence of death. So the question becomes, why, then, would this man of conscience and honor allow himself to be used as a pawn for immoral men such as Yeselnik? This dilemma followed me as I slowly crawled out of my bed and moved across the room to the window looking over the chapel's back wall and the dark waters of the gulf. I found my answer when I first peered out, before I lifted the glass pane and inadvertently viewed my own reflection. For I see the answer to Bonnegran of Pride when I look into the mirror darkly and honestly. Always a champion, never a laird, truly, for either of us. We dare to serve and serve extraordinarily well when duty is thrust upon us, when Bonnegran goes to fight Ethelbert and Branson goes to fight ancient Baden. But when the path is not determined by someone else of greater authority, then Bonnegran balks and Branson... I'll never forget the look on my face as I snickered before that glass in the pre-dawn room at St. Mirabel. I was naked, figuratively and literally. In the dark of night, in the long shadows, I had nowhere left to hide. For in the moment of truth and courage, I had run away. I had abandoned Riondu and Cormac and Michaela and Dame Guidra's cause and all that I knew to be right, because in that moment, I had been a coward. And in following this wicked and impetulant, as Jameson labeled him, King Yezelnik, so too is Bonnegran playing the role of the coward. Never on the field of battle, certainly, neither he nor I, but in the realm of responsibility, so alike are we, and so cowardly both. Would Bonnegran admit the truth of himself to himself, I wonder? And if he did, could he bring himself to march for King Yezelnik? From the time of Jameson's death, and despite my protest to the contrary, I meandered without purpose. Through the Southland and to Pride, then east to Bonnegran and north to St. Mirabel, my paths had been a mixture of self-delusion and self-denial, constantly thumbing my nose at the wider world in a pout of superiority and feigned indifference. For the first time since Jameson's murder, looking at my reflection in that dark room, the sound of Kaedale's steady breathing anchoring me, I knew my road. And I knew the consequence of failure to myself and to Hans.
Cormac knew better than to question Milkayla's instincts. The shaman had noted something amiss, some movement or sound, perhaps. She paced about their small encampment cautiously, peering into the darkness, holding her solid oaken staff in one hand and the loops of her toothy necklace in the other. She spoke to the trees and the grass, bidding them to tell her the secrets of those who walked near.
They tell me of no intruders.
But you do not believe them.
Someone, something is about. I sense it keenly.
Do you know where?
Cormac stopped suddenly and spun about, the hairs on the back of his neck standing up.
You felt that?
Or heard it?
Brother Cormac, he heard in his thoughts, not in exact words, but a representation of a greeting by a familiar voice. He recoiled instinctively, mental defenses rushing to the forefront to deny the intrusion. Even as he did that, hardly thinking of it, he sorted out the intrusion and knew then the source.
Brother Geoffno! Spirit walking! He seeks information so that he might report to Dame Guidra.
So we must tell him.
All of it. Has Dawson returned to St. Mirabel?
Yes!
Now knowing where to properly begin, Cormac started recounting their adventures at Laird Ethelbert's side, of the meeting with Bonnegran and Branson and the loss of Jameson Sequin.
We have not surrendered the notion of a truce with Laird Bonnegran yet. He seems not an unreasonable man, and Brother Riondu does not support the cause of Father de Gilb. Of that, I am sure.
He felt Giavno's approval and a sensation of farewell, and a moment later, Cormac looked at Milkayla and announced that they were alone. But they were not. Weary from his magical expenditures and from simply resisting the urge to possess Brother Cormac, Giavno's ghost swept out of the encampment. He wasn't sure if he wanted to soar through Bonnegran's lines to learn what he might of the powerful Laird, or return straight to St. Mirabel and report on Cormac's progress, perhaps to return the next night. Barely away from the couple, though, Brother Giavno found a detour. He sensed them before he saw them, their mortal forms compelling his wandering spirit toward them. Their positioning and posture warned him clearly enough, for they, two forms, crept along branches in the direction of Cormac and Milkayla.
Bandits?
Giavno flew in closer. Though he dared not try to reach the minds of either, he felt their malice and he saw their weapons. He sped back to the encampment.
Flee! Murderers! Flee!
Ishat Parzun crouched on the thick branch, twisting himself about in an effort to gain a clear look at the low firelight ahead. He held up his fist, signaling his companion to halt. He licked his dry lips, knowing that Afwen Wee would not be pleased if he failed in this. Half their band of eight had been killed, one in a fight with Milwellis's knights, two by the Jester II highwaymen, and one by the tall scout Sequin. Afwen Wee would tolerate no further failures. But this seemed simple enough. Ishat and Walloon had teamed on successful assassination several times before, and these two strangers did not seem so formidable. Not compared with the martial prowess of two Hugh Lee warriors, at least. Still, the assassin reminded himself to take it slow as he crept inch by inch along the unsweeping branch, moving closer to the firelight and higher. The victims were scrambling. They knew it. Ishat Parzun leaped to his feet and waved Walloon forward. Off Ishat ran along the branch, leaping to another and taking a circuitous route to the right of the couple. Cormac grabbed at his arm, and Ishat understood that Walloon had scored a hit with a shuriken. Now Walloon had the attention of the couple, and Ishat rushed along, confident of the kill. To the side and above, he leaped and executed a twisting somersault, catching a branch in his grasp. He swung under, but held fast as the branch bent forward under his momentum. And then it hit him, as solidly as if a club had struck him on the side of his head. Ishat Parzun had never been violated in this manner before, and the sudden and vicious encroachment of another soul into his mortal body revolted him so profoundly that he lost all sense of where he was. He flew from the branch, tumbling out of control. He landed feet first, but falling forward, hooking his toes awkwardly, and the ground rushed up to slam him in the face. But Ishat didn't feel that impact, or the blood rushing out of his shattered nose, or the sharp pain about one eye from a crushed socket. No. His pain was internal at that awful moment, as a clawing, shadowy form assailed something more profound and sensitive than his flesh, as an invading spirit fought to expel him from his own corporeal coil. Milkayla shoved Cormac out of the way of the flying black-clad form. The back of his arm torn and burning with fiery pain, Cormac stumbled and fell to one knee as the assassin flew past him, landing hard. The man's awkward descent made no sense to Cormac and Milkayla, for they thought these warriors akin to the graceful highwayman. The monk didn't focus on that unexplained event, though. Expecting more of the sharp missiles from the man crossing the other side of the encampment, Cormac threw himself into a forward roll and came back to his feet, angling to the side. He spied the other assailant, the man's arm up to throw, but before he even executed the throw, the small campfire exploded, directionally, and with the blast aimed right at the star-throwing assailant. Sparks and cinders cut through the darkness, and the warrior launched himself sidelong through the air. Cormac glanced at Milkayla. Of course she had done that.
Come! Quickly! We know not how many more are about!
Together they ran into the tree line. They had barely reached the trees when Milkayla spun back and raised her staff and necklace, and Cormac noted a wave of energy, like the distortion of a heated surface, roll out from her. The assailant nearest them writhed on the ground, seemingly out of his senses, but the other man had nimbly come back to his feet. He started forward but jerked weirdly, for the grass was grabbing at his feet, and when he tore one foot free, a clump of dirt went flying. He did well to regain his balance almost immediately, but then a branch bent down at him as if grabbing at him. And indeed it was. Cormac marveled at his wife's attunement with the plants about them. Now Milkayla went with him into the darkness of the tree line, but barely had they entered when the woman stopped and shook her head, looking back the way they had come. If Brother Giavno could have seen his own body far across the miles in St. Mirabel, he was certain that his face would be streaked with tears. The tumult and darkness of possession engulfed him and swirled and jumbled everything he had known to be good or evil. Even so, he could not stop. For the sake of Cormac and Milkayla, perhaps for the success or failure of the war itself, he could not surrender this battle. So he thrashed, losing himself in the fury of the moment, battling for control, muscle by muscle. The body he had invaded was enough his own at that point for him to feel the grab on his shoulder when the assassin's companion came by, yanking him roughly to his feet.
He shot!
He saw momentarily out of Ishat's eyes to witness the other man lift his arm, a small circular throwing missile in hand. The monk gained enough control of one arm to lash out, his punch slamming his companion in the jaw just as he moved to throw. The momentum had Ishad stumbling forward into the lurching man, at least until that warrior deftly and powerfully caught his balance and shifted in a twist, throwing Ishad over his hip, face first into the fire. Arms and legs began thrashing, desperately trying to get out of the blaze. They hit the dirt and began rolling about wildly to douse the biting flames.
Ishad!
The assassin went to his fallen friend, slapping at the flames and trying to roll the wounded man over. The black-clad man lifted his friend's arm, then threw his arms up defensively as Cormac flew in sidelong, a heavy body block. Cormac was no stranger to battle. He focused from run to leap to body block. All that he wanted to do was get his legs wrapped around the man's neck. And he did, and he clamped down with all his strength. The man reached up at him, or tried to, but the grass grabbed at him once more, further pinning him at Milkela's command.
The other one!
The downed assailant pulled an arm free and slapped at Cormac's leg, but weakly and too late, and Cormac just rolled himself to the side, bending the doomed man's head back with a turn. The pain did not abate, though the flames were gone, for now it was of a different source, a brutal strength of muscle against muscles, of muscles against themselves. Brother Giovanni and Ishad battled furiously within the wounded body. Ishad instinctively countering every attempt by Giovanni to garner any control of any part of the body that belonged to him. Normally, a possessing brother in such a situation would be expelled. His own reactions to the horror of possession would weaken his willpower enough for the host spirit to throw him far. But Giovanni knew the stakes here, and he fought harder and more furiously, pointedly sending his demands to parts of the body where he believed Ishad to be weakest. They thrashed and squirmed, rolled about and kicked and flailed wildly. Giovanni managed to gain control of the one eye that was not swollen shut, just in time to catch a glimmer of Milkela's form standing over them, of Milkela's staff fast descending. A burst of senselessness, an explosion of white fire that quickly dulled to nothingness sent Giovanni spiraling uncontrollably. Again, though, he did not exit the corporeal form, but instead felt a contraction, a pointed tightness and grip in his, in Ishad's chest. Then he felt a sudden cold sensation and saw a flood of light, distant and surrounded by blackness, as if he was looking through a dark tube, and growing, rushing toward him, and he toward it. He felt nothing. He knew nothing. Brother Giovanni, the collection of memories and experiences and thoughts that comprised the consciousness of the man known as Brother Giovanni, felt a rush of freedom as his soul flew from Ishat's dying corporeal form. Then nothing. Emptiness. A void. Non-existence. Brother Giovanni's eyes popped open wide, and he reflexively threw himself to the side, crashing into the wall of the small meditation room at St. Mirabel. He tried to make sense of what he had seen, to put it in the perspective of Blessed Abel and the promises of eternity. He tried, but everything jumbled too quickly. He tried to call for Brother Pinauer, for Father Primujan. It was the garbled nonsense of a spirit-walking brother gone insane. In a brief moment of clarity, Brother Giovanni understood the source of his malady and from that deduced the source of his too common loss of sensibility that occurred with brothers who dared use the Soul Stone to such dangerous extents. He couldn't cry out clearly, couldn't form a cogent phrase, because he wasn't alone. Ishad, some manner of the being that had once been Ishad of Bear, had come back with him and now, reflexively, instinctively, battled Giovanni for control. Giovanni stood, turned toward the door, and pushed his way into the corridor. Other brothers were around him. He saw through fast-blinking, flittering eyes. They grabbed him and supported him.
Brother Giovanni! What is wrong, Brother Giovanni?
He knew, and those around him knew, but they had seen this before. The struggle was not the same as the one that had occurred in Ishad. There was no fight for control of Giavno's physical form, and no danger that he would tear himself apart muscle against muscle. But Giavno found his every thought stabbed by the raw emotion and unbridled terror of the utterly lost soul of Ishat Barzun.
What was that?
Milkela stared wide-eyed at the very still form on the ground below her. She glanced over at Cormac, who finally dared to unwrap his legs from the assailant's neck.
I did not hit him that hard.
Brother Giovno.
Cormac climbed to his feet and bent over the fallen bear warrior, bringing his fingers to the man's throat to see if his blood still pumped.
Alive, barely.
He walked over to join his beloved, then similarly bent over the burned and battered body.
Brother Giovno, he waged an internal war. Brave man, we owe him our lives.
He stood up and closed his eyes and was very glad when Milkela wrapped him in a tight hug. Milkela broke off the hug and moved toward the prone man. She moved to restrain him, but Cormac cut in before her and kicked the man hard in the face.
For Giovno.
He rolled the man over, tugging his arms tightly behind his back.
We need some rope or cloth.
Milkela moved to a nearby tree thick with climbing grapevines. She stroked the trunk gently and gave a slight tug on the vine, which dropped to the ground beside her. Milkela moved beside Cormac. She placed the vine on the ground beside the man.
Uvera est toca vostis.
The vine began to crawl of its own accord. It snaked up onto the man's back and slithered about his wrists. Winding ever more tightly, the vine wrapped intricately, weaving in and out and about. With the man's wrists secured many times over, the vine's remaining length climbed up his back and looped like a constrictor about the poor fellow's neck.
He'll not get free. Let us be quick to Pride and Laird Barnegrin.
If Barnegrin learns of this attack, if he recognizes our prisoner, as he surely will, then how are we to assure him that Laird Ethelbert is trustworthy and deserving of alliance?
How are we to believe that?
For Dame Guidra, then. We will speak not on behalf of Laird Ethelbert.
For Dame Guidra and Father Ottolevan. For the good of all the folk of Haunts.
2 days later, they arrived in Pride Town, less than an hour after Bonnegrand's army had settled about the place.
Clear sailing in the Gulf and Dawson will be ashore in 3 days.
Dame Guidra rushed into the audience hall of Father Primujan. The woman quieted immediately, though, when she noted the tenor of the place. She brought her hand to her mouth to muffle her gasp when she spotted Brother Giovno laid out on a bench to the side of the dais. Brothers Pinaur and Jurgian crouched over him, with Father Primujan and several of the chapel's masters standing nearby, shaking their heads solemnly.
What has happened?
The perils of spirit walking. He has been driven to madness, no doubt through the sin of possession.
Can you help him?
Jurgian shrugged.
We have sent for Branson. Perhaps his mystical skills and the power of our gemstones will penetrate the veil Brother Giovno has constructed.
It is a terrible loss. But it will not be the last we can expect.
Primujan stepped over and herded Pinaur and Jurgian away from Giovno's twitching body.
The army of Vanguard approaches. We must make our preparations and be out to the east to greet them. You have a great and vital march ahead of you, brothers. Go now and sleep. It has been a long night.
The man is my friend. I cannot leave.
You would honor him by deserting the cause to which he has so greatly sacrificed?
No, Father.
Brother Jurgian caught up to Pinaur and supported him, and also patted Guidra comfortingly on the shoulder as he walked past her. The two brothers neared the exit as Branson, Kaedale, and Callan came rushing in. Branson moved right past them, sprinting to Giavno's side, and Pinaur and Jurgian paused to watch, both making the sign of the evergreen. Beside Branson, who was already crouching over Brother Giovno, Father Primujan waved them out of the room.
Can you help him?
Branson looked at her doubtfully. Without saying a word, he unwrapped his bandana and took down the soulstone Master Riandu had given him. He clutched it tightly in his hand, feeling its magic keenly, then placed it on the forehead of Brother Giovno. Almost immediately, the man's eyes flickered open and began to twitch. Branson felt the spiritual connection to Giovno. He pictured his own line of Gichi-Cree running like a thin line of lightning from his head to his groin. Then, in the swirl of the hematite, he saw Giovno's line and felt the constant interruptions to it, the stabbing outbursts of protest causing it to flicker and spasm. Branson broke the connection and fell back confused. He opened his eyes to find Guaidra and Primujan hovering about him, staring at him hopefully.
I don't know.
With a glance at Kaydale, who nodded her agreement, he fell back into the stone, seeking again Brother Giavno's Kichi Kree. It seemed like only a matter of moments, but most of the morning had passed before Branson again opened his eyes and looked outside the spiritual experience of the Soul Stone. Guaidra was gone from the room, as were Callan and most of the monks, but Kaydale and Father Primujan sat together on a nearby bench.
Branson, what do you know?
Brother Giavno is in there, but he is not alone.
Possession?
Branson shook his head, unsure.
One of Degilb's traitorous monks?
No.
He wasn't certain. He needed to go back and try again to separate Brother Giavno from this other entity. Enough, at least, to try to gain some information from the monk. But what he needed most of all was to rest.
After supper, in the quiet night.
Dame Guaidra wishes you to be out before the dawn. You must march with her.
I am surprised that you came to Castle Pride instead of the chapel.
Cormac, Milkayla, and their prisoner had been marched into Bonnegran's hall.
But I see that you come bearing a gift, at least.
Hey, Devan! Free me!
Bonnegran warned him to silence with a wagging finger.
That is one of Ethelbert's hired assassins, I expect.
I believe his name is Walloon, else that is a bear word meaning something else.
Walloon! Hule!
You have seen the truth of the war, then. That Ethelbert cannot win. And so you have betrayed him to win my graces. You think to impress me with treachery?
Treachery?
That you wish to change your allegiance is for your own conscience, but to so deceive a Laird...
No, Laird Bonnegran. We come as emissaries to promote the cause of alliance.
Dame Guaidra beside Bonnegran of Pride, and with the Order of Blessed Abel supporting their cause against King Yeselnik.
Emissaries with a gift?
Not gained through treachery. Not our own, in any case. This man and a companion attacked us on the road. If there was treachery afoot, it was...
Ethelbert's!
Laird Ethelbert!
No!
On a motion from Bonnegran, a pair of guards rushed up to the man and dragged him away.
Laird Ethelbert tried to kill you, then. Perhaps he is not as fond of your Dame Guaidra as you believe.
If it was Ethelbert...
That is one of his assassins, is it not?
It is. But it is senseless for Laird Ethelbert to try and kill us, even as we support his cause, likely his only hope, to Bonnegran of Pride.
Then what?
I know not.
Ethelbert's court divided.
Cormac could only hold up his empty hands.
We will learn soon enough.
Bonnegran waved the guards to drag Walloon to the dungeons.
Laird Bonnegran, I protest!
Master Riando came in the door just as Walloon was being taken out.
They come to us as emissaries under a flag of truce!
Truly, he squeezes the blood from my heart. You remember Cormac and his wife Milkayla?
Riando glanced at the couple and still seemed ready to erupt, but his expression soon enough changed to one of curiosity, as he clearly saw that the two weren't bound.
We brought the assassin in as a prisoner.
It is a long tale they can tell to you at your chapel.
Bonnegran waved for more attendants to escort them all out.
Laird, I beg you to reconsider your course. Dame Guaidra is noble in heart and mind. The cause of the Order of Blessed Abel is just. My Laird, please.
My course is to kill Powery's monk. There is no course more just than that. Riando, keep them in your chapel. I will call for you shortly, as soon as I have spoken to the prisoner.
Spoken to?
With all the respect due to an assassin. I promise.
As soon as his spirit entered the realm of Brother Giavno, Branson found himself enmeshed in a spinning and confusing jumble of opposing thoughts and wants and emotions. It wasn't an internal argument of the kind every man experienced, and not based in simple puzzlement or torn loyalties or fear of unexpected consequences. No. This jumble was more akin to swirling thoughts and demands, unrelated to and seemingly unaware of contradictory notions moving right beside them, even merging with them.
Chaos. Pure and unblemished chaos.
Branson tried to search further but found himself distracted. And when he tried to examine the distraction, he found himself distracted again in an entirely new direction. Branson rushed back through the Soul Stone portal, back into his own body, and opened his eyes. He stood and rubbed his face and shook his head.
What do you know? What did you see?
Branson tried to formulate some cogent response. What had he seen? He had sensed the identity of Brother Giavno, a man he knew fairly well from their travels in Alpinador and Vanguard, inside the tumultuous swirl of discordant thoughts. Images of blowing desert sands and dome-topped shining marble structures, pink and white and some covered in gold, flashed in Branson's mind. Little specks of the southern kingdom of Bear, he knew, for he had seen the same type of architecture, on a far lesser scale, in Ethelbert Das Entel.
Had Brother Giavno traveled to Bear?
To Alpinador, but never south of Polkri that I've heard.
Spiritually, is it possible that he flew his soul all the way to the desert lands?
Brother Pinau's face screwed up for a moment. He shook his head, but then merely shrugged.
He was not assigned to any such thing. His mission this night was to find Cormac and Mikaela and learn, perhaps, of their progress. Nothing more.
Branson considered the words and thought of the last time he had met with Cormac and Mikaela. They accompanied people who would know of such sights as those he had found inside, the spinning memories within Brother Giavno. Was it possible that there truly was another entity trapped inside the mind of the mad monk?
Dueling spirits.
How so?
Or pieces of consciousness. They fight for control of the man's mind. One other consciousness, at least, and that battle manifests itself as Brother Giovno's madness.
How could this be? Is it the mind of another brother who's out spirit-walking? Surely not Cormac!
I believe that Brother Giovno possessed someone, likely someone far in the south, and he has inadvertently taken a piece of that person back with him to St. Mirabel. Both of them trapped in his one mind, vying for supremacy, though they likely are not even aware of the other. Perhaps that is always the way with the madness that sometimes results with spirit-walking. In the act of possession, you are aware of your dalliance, and surely your target understands and recoils immediately from the intrusion. And so it is a furious and desperate battle of willpower, but one with singular identities. This, brother, this is true madness, an oblivious mingling of two minds, two spirits, two souls. I cannot...
Does the mind that is still Giavno know anything about the progress in the south?
Branson glanced back at the man.
Dame Guaidra will be out within an hour.
Branson nodded and sat down again beside the dreaming and restless monk.
No, Branson, you came forth in fear. Do not risk your own clarity again in the madness that is Brother Giavno.
I know what I will find in there now.
They swept down from the high ground across the grassy banking, waving their weapons and banging their shields. In the small town before and below them, where every man, woman, and child lay dead or dying, 70 Powries adjusted their bloody caps, glowing with fresh blood, and grinned wickedly. To the side of the rise and the main charge, Prince Milwellis stood in his chariot, expecting this fight to go as had the previous two. His losses would be significant, he expected, perhaps as many as 200 men, but in the end, the Powries would be eliminated.
There is fear in their eyes.
Everyone knew the horseman was speaking of the Palmaris Town garrison and not the unshakable dwarves.
Hold steady! Our footmen will not flee the field!
The footmen, peasants mostly and expendable, would swarm the town, flushing out all of the enemies, and only when their sheer numbers facilitated a Powry retreat would Milwellis and his veteran riders and charioteers sweep in from the sides to claim ultimate and final victory. They had 1,000 men descending upon this hamlet. The Powries might kill them 15-1 and still be massacred in the end. The end. Milwellis was cunning enough to understand and callous enough to accept was all that mattered.
Powries, out to the west!
The spotter positioned in the tree above informed them.
They're breaking!
And sails?
North!
The prince nodded, for the trap was in place.
Ride with the smell of burning Palmaris Town in your noses. Ride with the sight of ruined buildings and murdered children in your eyes. Ride with the blow of the horn of Palmaris in your ears and know this day that these dwarves we trample under hoof and under wheel will never again spill the blood of our families.
Hold, Milwellis!
The prince turned to see a soldier rushing toward him, waving his arms frantically. Behind the man, coming at a slower pace, marched Harcourt and some others.
General Harcourt bids you to send forth your legion as planned, but for you to hold and await his arrival.
What foolishness is this? Stand aside or be run down.
No, my lad.
Milwellis took up his reins as if to proceed, but then held back as the word Laird registered. He turned a shocked expression at Harcourt's courier. All around and behind Milwellis, horses began to trot and chariots to roll as General Harcourt, rushing forward as fast as his old legs would carry him, prodded the horsemen and charioteers to begin their charge.
What did you call me?
By the time Harcourt reached Milwellis' side, most of the cavalry was away, thundering along their predetermined course to intercept the Powry retreat.
Milwellis, my friend. Ill news from the north.
My father?
His force was overrun by Dame Gwydra. My friend, my laird, Laird Panlamaris of Palmaris Town, is slain.
No, this cannot be. That damned witch of Vanguard, get you to your team. Let us ride in together to bring ruin to these filthy dwarves, that I might turn my army back to Chapel Arbel and exact revenge upon the witch of Vanguard.
Your safety is paramount for the next few days, my laird. The city cannot lose two beloved lairds in so near a time to each other.
Your concern is touching, truly. Now get to your team and let us slaughter some Powry marauders.
Sails north!
Picklebrin looked to McWiggick, the pair rolling along as fast as their short and bandy legs could carry them. Their caps shone bright this day, and three of Milwellis's soldiers had been taken down between them, although they argued with every stride about who struck the killing blow on the last human. But while Powrys could be as savage as any creature on Corona, and as stubbornly brave as the demon Dactyls, they weren't outright suicidal. Usually.
And lots of them! Won't be easy getting out!
Worth trying even? Sure that our hearts will be harder to find at the bottom of a river!
Oh, you're wanting to stake up your bum then!
Last kill was me own!
Ah, you hit a corpse! You're too slow with your hatchet!
Yeah, but when we're done killing the fools here, know that I'll spill your own blood, McWiggett, to Cigaron Lay!
And there it was. Spoken openly, as clear an admission that they were surely doomed as any Powry would ever utter.
Spear!
Picklebrin glanced his friend's way to see the shaft of a javelin dragging behind McWiggick. His eyes widened as he looked past McWiggick, and McWiggick too turned about to note a chariot bearing down on them, the red-haired man driving it, all bedecked in bejeweled shining bronze armor and hoisting another javelin to throw. McWiggick was flying then, thrown out of the way by his friend Picklebrin. He bounced sidelong over the banking to tumble and bounce through the grass. He landed face down in the mud by the riverbank, half in and half out of the flowing water. McWiggick struggled to his knees and elbows. McWiggick heard the chariot rock and bounce as it passed over him, then it pulled up short.
Come on, you blood-haired son of a fisherman's whore!
McWiggick knew his friend was dying. He forced himself up higher and reached back, grasping the spear shaft with one hand. He closed his eyes and yanked the spear free, dropping it into the dark water beside him. He tried to stand, but couldn't get higher than one knee. And when he lifted his head upright, the world began to spin before him. He saw his enemy, though, through the dizzy blur. The red-haired human approached in a straightforward and fearless manner, sword in hand and dripping blood.
Picklebrin's blood!
The Powry threw his short iron sword, and the man stumbled back. He didn't fall, though. And when he straightened again, the side of his face covered in blood, he began his determined march against the now unarmed and badly weakened McWiggick.
Yuck! But you're a boot stump frog!
He didn't feel the water as he splashed face down into the Maesor Delaval.